everyone. I'm calling the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection in order. One housekeeping matter that I've been told, and I'm going to lead by example, I guess. If you have a BlackBerry or a cell phone, apparently it will cause some difficulty within the sound system in the room, even if it's in a standby mode, and so they need to be turned off so it will not interfere with the recording of the hearing. So I will turn mine off and ask that everyone else will do the same while you're in. We're not trying to interfere with your business that you may have, but at the same time we need to make certain that we have a good copy of the tape. And if you heard the little buzzing, that is one of the things that they're concerned with. So we have a number of items that we're going to be updated on and taking on a few new items. The first one that we have today is consumer goods mislabeling issues. I have two individuals that will be presenting some information. Ron, why don't you come on up, and Mr. Wright, the two of you come up together, and I believe we're going to have someone from one of the agencies, the Department of Ag, that will be giving us a little bit more information. And for committee members, Judith has provided us with background information on various topics that we'll be dealing with, and I know that there's some regarding this first topic. And Mr. Davis and Mr. Wright, I'm going to let y'all lead off as to your presentation as to who's going to go first. Just please state your name for the record before you give your testimony.
Sure. My name's Ron Davis, and I live down outside of Cottage Grove. I've been there for 30-some years. And my concern is, and I appreciate you all coming here today and listening to this. You know, you are a representative, and I know you get paid a whole lot of money for doing this. I checked into it.
This isn't D.C.
Yeah, it's not. And I actually gave about $400 to get here today myself, so I work in the healthcare profession. The background that I go back to is back about 17 years ago, I started a bottled water business. And I did that because there was concern about the education system in our local area. And my daughter chose to want to go to a private school. So I started a bottled water business to help supplement the income so I could send her to a private school. And then she worked in the business, and I paid her. Okay, so right after we started the business, we were approached by a local dairy saying, hey, we got a big client for you. I said, great, you know, we're in business, that's what we want to do. 12 to 13 pallets a week, you can sell bottled water, and we'll sell you the bottles, so your milk jugs. I said, yeah, that's great. You know, and it was to a big box there locally in the Eugene area. And all I had to do was bottle water and slap a label on it, their label. Their label was McKenzie Springs. Well, I started thinking, we don't live up in McKenzie, and it's not a spring. We have a well. So that was the first red flag. And then I started asking myself, why do you want to give us your business? Because they were bottling two days a week. Wednesdays and Thursdays, they'd wash out their lines, take out the milk, and then run city water into it, and then slap a label that said McKenzie Springs on it. So people are going into the big box there thinking, I'm getting a spring water, and actually they're getting the same water they're getting by turning on the tap without filtering it. They could have put a filter on their tap. So what I discovered was they were playing games with the different bottlers and saying, okay, this guy will do it for, 50 cents. How about you doing it for 49? And so they just slowly worked it down. That's why they didn't want to do the business anymore. They just wanted to sell us bottles because they made money. Okay, 1995, 96, somewhere around there, the FDA rose up and said, hey, this is not right. This is mislabeled product. You know, people need to know where the water's coming from. So they passed a regulation that says that, basically, as I understand it still, if you have a name of your company that has a geological or geographical place, like Sierra, and it says Springs, and that's the name of your company, and it's not from the Sierras, and it's not from a spring, you need to put a disclaimer on the principal label, either preceding or right after, in half the size lettering, as to where that water's coming from. Now, you don't have to go too far. You can turn around and look at that label there, and tell me, you know, where is that disclaimer? Okay. So my concern was about, oh, 3 years ago or so, I ran into somebody up in Portland delivering Sierra Springs. I asked them, I says, hey, where do you get your water from? He says, Bull Run, but we have a spring too. I said, okay. I was down in Eugene. I saw another driver. I asked, where do you get your water from? Bull Run, but we have a spring too. And it sounds like they've been coached. I don't know. I might be wrong. So I came up here for another situation, which I won't go into detail. And I was walking through the Capitol, and I see this product. So I wrote the governor, explained all this to him. You know, I got the letter. I can give you a copy of it. I think, Floyd, you've got a letter. Copy that letter. I hand-delivered it to one of his aides. So I know he got it. He never responded to that letter. Okay. So my concern is a couple of things. Is I understand the state has budget problems. Okay. So if you got budget problems, number one, why are you buying a filtered product? Because that's what I understand that product is. It comes from the tap. In fact, I've got a cap here. If you want to see it, that they used to have on that particular product that said in very small letters, source, municipal water supply of Portland. Okay. And that's the little cap that's on the top that you rip off and throw away. Now that cap doesn't even give a source. I mean, I've got that here too. What it says is, it's very small letter, purified by reverse osmosis and or distillation filtered and ozonation to ensure quality. Okay. Now, what I suggested to the governor, if you want to save money, you know, put some filters on your tap. You know, if you want to save, you know, air pollution, then don't buy a product that needs to be driven down from Portland. You know, you got water right here. You could filter it here. But even better, you know, if you want to support Oregon, why don't you buy water from people who have businesses in Oregon? At the time when I did the research and I went into the internet and I looked up this, and I said, well, at least, you know, it's Sierra Springs, because that's my concern. Why are you buying water from California? We got water in Oregon. But then when you go a step further, you say, oh, wait, but it's filtered water from Portland. But then when you go a step further, at that time, it was owned by a Japanese firm. So you weren't even buying from somebody in the United States. You're buying from a foreign multinational company. So that's my concern. I was relating this to Floyd. We were talking about another issue that concerns me, which is much bigger issue regarding health care.
Which, unfortunately, this committee's not going to...
Exactly. We're not going to go into that. But Floyd picked up the ball on it, and he's my representative, and he said, well, you know, we'll have a hearing on this, and we'll talk about it. So here we are talking. And what I would like to do is just, you know, get the folks to comply, you know, or else, you know, get it out of the place where we write the rules. I mean, this is where you write the rules. People come, and they see something like that, and it's non-compliant, as far as I can tell. I haven't got anybody to explain to me how it's in compliance yet. And I've contacted Peter DeFazio, Gordon Smith, the Attorney General. In fact, I've filed a complaint with the Attorney General and never heard from them regarding this. The FDA, I mean, I'm sorry, the Department of Agriculture was just an inspection, got back to me and said, well, we're waiting for the FDA to get back to you. I waited a year and a half. Finally, they got back to me in writing and said, we may or may not look into this, investigate it. And I wrote them back. I said, what's the investigation? When your inspector is standing there in Portland watching the water go in the bottle and it says Sierra Springs, you can ask the question, do you have a pipeline from here to the Sierras? And is there a spring at the end of it? So that's basically my concern, and I'd like to see the state. You know, if you're gonna have rules, then let's enforce them. You know, why do you guys come up here and spend all this time writing rules if we're not gonna enforce them? Unless they're selective rules.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Thank you,
Mr. Wright. Did you have other comments you'd like to add to the testimony we've heard?
Yeah, I think there's a couple issues. My background.
I need to first ask you to just state your name for the record, so it's on the tape.
Yeah, Frank Wright, and I live in Harrisburg, Oregon. My background has been public water supply. I've started in the private sector. I've had contractors licensing for putting together community water systems. I've owned a community water system. I've worked as a public works director, purveying potable water to communities. I worked as a production supervisor for municipal tap water. And my background has been looking at the 1976, the Safe Drinking Water Act, had all of the public water supplies look at the quality of the water. Those report cards came out and actually drove the consumer to the market looking for alternatives to tap water. That's when I decided to get into the business. And I went to a great expense getting some property, getting artesian source, building improvements on and off the property to handle the 53-foot trucks to engage in that business. And one of the probably the pivotal points of those identity standards was because this was consumer-driven, because this was being pulled in and competing with the national beverage companies, the FDA was very cautious to make sure that people were aware that this that the product source and treatment, that the product in the bottle wasn't a municipal tap water. And I think that's the pivotal point that both Ron's been working independent for me. In fact, that we probably never spent more than 15, 20 minutes together. Just as a colleague in the trade, but we have this same common issue, and that's the consumer fraud of putting municipal tap water in a bottle and misrepresenting on the label where those value judgments are the product and the content of that water. It's a relatively new product, and this phenomenon of being water in a bottle is relatively new. So we're still in the kind of the growing and correcting stages of that particular product. 1996 was the identity standards, and there was some ramp up to that point, education ramp up within the trade. And I went to all the IBWA meetings and stuff, and there was a lot of notice to bottlers to be truthful for the trade and the consumer. This is 10 years later, and that has every representation, that bottle, the 5-gallon bottle says Sierra Springs, has every representation of being spring water. Well, that's municipal tap water. That's false and misleading to the general consumer. If you're in the trade, and my background being in public water supply, I've gone and repaired some screens on some big holding tanks where varmints and birds and stuff can get in to those holding tanks. There are critical points within municipal tap or municipal supplies that create you either have approved or unapproved water, and there's too many potential critical points within that system to always say that you have 100% potable water. And that's what drove then this trade. Those consumers wanted to eliminate that potential. They want to pay a dollar, more virtually, buck and a half a gallon. It used to be about the same price of the gas, but they would pay out of their pocket. Yeah, it's about half the price now. But they would pay out of their pocket for something they would be assured of is not a municipal tap water. But this fraud continues. And that is there. Probably 80% of the bottlers in the United States or across from in this nation take municipal tap waters, put it in a bottle, and sell it as either a purified product or a drinking water product. And then there's a small segment of bottlers that actually try and take a natural component, or a natural water, and put it in a bottle and meet that need of that discerning consumer. Some are price point driven. This one at Safeway is 50 cents a gallon, municipal tap water, but it says on there that it's from a community system filtered. But there are products out on the market right now that take the same municipal tap water and get $1.69 a gallon. So 50 cents. Now, the consumer is under the impression that this is a regulated business. It's not. It has regulations, but they're not enforced. So I elected to get into this business from the public water supplies, knowing that there are people looking for an alternative to their municipal tap waters, and continually fight this issue of being truthful to the consumer. So I'm here today. I have, unfortunately to me, my background's been put in the public sector where it is a, you construe yourself as a public servant, and good faith, you do these things for the good of the population. But I got into business, and there are a lot of unethical business people making a lot of money doing something that I perceive as unethical. And I was subjected to retaliations from a large company that I blew the whistle on. And I had all my small package, because of their influence, had all my small package sales completely taken away. Then I got into the home and office delivery, but it was unrecoverable. But I'm here to support Ron and all the other bottlers and the public, the consuming public, that is under the impression that water in a bottle might be something different, and it's not. So the public water supplies serve up water at usually $1.50 a thousand gallons tapped into your home, and virtually you get the same thing in a bottle. You pay at least 50 cents or sometimes up to $1.69 a gallon, and that's a ripoff.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I believe we have someone here from the Department of Agriculture,
yes.
Mr. McKay. Gentlemen, if you all step back, we'll have someone else come up to the podium. Good morning,
Chair.
McKay.
Good morning. My name is Ron McKay. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
I want to first thank you for coming over on very short notice. I understand that you had some conversations with our assistant yesterday, providing some information, or someone from your office, and unfortunately didn't get the message that we actually would like to have had someone here, and thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
So maybe if you can just kind of give us an overview as to the position that the agency provides for regulating in this area, and also maybe answer some questions that we have regarding what, if any, regulations the state could take on if we chose to go in that area.
I'd be glad to. The Department of Agriculture Food Safety Division has adopted the Code of Federal Regulations, which deals with bottled water. Oregon has not adopted any separate rules for bottled water. The product that goes into a bottle falls under the jurisdiction of the Department of Agriculture. The city or community water systems are done by the Oregon Health Division under the Drinking Water Program. So there are two different programs. So we administer the Code of Federal Regulations, and we have been doing that for a number of years. I don't know exactly when this started or when the adoption was, but I'm going to guess it was probably 20 years ago. Excuse me. There have been some changes over the years, but not that many.
Okay.
So is that... I guess I would answer any specific questions you would have.
Yeah. First, I'll open up to the panel. Senator Maxwell first.
Thank you for coming. I guess I'm interested to hear, because you heard the testimony, since regulations are great, but they're not doing anything about it, even when it's clear that these things are mislabeled. You know, you're coming from the municipal water supply, and it's saying it comes from a creek, and that there is absolutely, you know, and we all know about having, and we have a lot of stuff on the books that nothing ever happens with it. And basically the charge is that, yeah, we have regulations, but they don't do anything about it. Would you comment on that, and whether there has been, if you can give me any examples of any crackdown on any of these water suppliers that you've been engaged in for violating the regulations?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, we have been enforcing these regulations for a number of years, but as with anything, there are things that get missed. We have city water systems, wells, springs, a number of sources of water that go into bottled water. I don't know the exact number of bottled water firms across the state, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 50 or more. Many of them have wells, springs, but there are also quite a few of them that take from municipal water systems. They're required to put that on the label. Our staff who do the inspection check to see if the label is correct, if the source is properly identified. They're looking for the testing that is required to be done to see that that is carried out. And then they look at the facilities, the handling practices, the bottling procedures to see that all of those are carried out correctly. I won't say that everything is perfect, but we are attempting to enforce the regulations uniformly across the industry. This also would go into some other areas. We have, for instance, we have ice and we have other forms that water is offered for sale to the public, and we're inspecting those areas also.
So you're inspecting and looking, but have you found violations? And if so, what did you do about them? Or have you not found any violations, and to the best of your knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, one of the issues we found was an example that I think Mr. Wright had up here earlier, the Earth2O label that was on their bottled water did not identify it as from a community source. This labeling was on an alternate display panel, not on the principal display panel. That was something that Mr. Wright pointed out to us, something that we got corrected a few years ago. I'm not exactly sure when that was. There are examples, or maybe I should say, if Mr. Wright has some other examples, we would be glad to look into those.
And one just final question,
yes.
And I think Senator Starr's waiting. Yes. Just, this is your opinion. I'm asking for your opinion on this with the Department of Agriculture. As a consumer, okay, do you believe that the consumer would be better served if there were more, if there were tighter regulations for greater clarity on disclosure of sources on these products?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I believe the labeling requirements that are currently in place do identify all the information that a consumer would need to know. So, to read the label, to know that it's spring water or water from a community system, that water has standards that it must meet, I think the consumer would have all the information they would need.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here, Mr. McKay. The question I have is, do you have enough staff to properly regulate and enforce the current regulations on this particular industry?
I'm sorry, sir. I don't know that I understood the question.
Well, we've got a complaint that these folks that are selling this water aren't labeling it correctly, identifying it correctly. Do you believe that you have enough staff to properly enforce the regulations that are on the books? We've got a copy of the regulations. I don't think that we need to change those. I think that they're pretty thorough from what I've read here. But do you have enough staff? Is it an issue of just not providing enough manpower out there in the field to look at all these companies?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I believe we have adequate staff to enforce these. If there's something we're missing, we would be happy to look into it. It is part of a routine inspection to look at labeling as well as the other practices that go on, but we can miss things. So if there's a specific example, we would be more than happy to look into it.
Great, thank you.
Senator Devlin.
What is your background in terms of education? I'm just trying to find out if you have a science background.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Zoology from Oregon State. I'm required in this position to be a registered sanitarian, which requires a minimum of 45 hours of science. It requires a minimum of 2 years' experience. And then taking a national exam. So,
follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
If I have spring water in one bottle and I have, water in a bottle that's from the primary source that my city has, which is the Bull Run, is there any difference in the chemical composition? Is there anything that you could distinguish that would say one is better or worse?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, there may not be anything different in the two. An analysis of the water could indicate possibly some differences in mineral content. But the main thing that we're concerned with when we look at bottled water is the safety of the product, coliform levels, and then to make sure that any of the harmful bacteria, nitrates, heavy metals are not in there at any level that would cause any harm.
Follow up, Mr.
Please.
Are there some areas that you regulate in terms of food quality where you could mislabel something where there would be an actual difference between them? I don't know if you or just the USDA does meat inspections. Does your department do them also, or is it just the USDA?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, we do, the Department of Agriculture licenses all meat establishments in the state. We inspect custom establishments. Those facilities that are under continuous USDA inspection, we don't duplicate their effort.
Okay. What I'm trying to identify is there may be some areas where there's actually a difference in the quality between products, and you could mislabel a product, and you'd actually be buying something thinking it was something that had a higher value versus a lower value. I'm trying to think of an example of that that you might monitor. Have you received any many citizen complaints about this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, on bottled water, we have not received that many citizen complaints. Generally, the complaints that come in are in the nature of there is something, a piece of foreign material, there is something in the water, something floating or something that is suspended, maybe yeast or mold, it may be a piece of foreign material, it may be improper capping of the container. The types of the complaints that we receive are mostly in those areas.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. McKay, just a couple of questions. I look over at the 5-gallon dispenser we have and see the name Sierra Springs, as large as it is. Understand the disclaimer, or let's say the information that goes to the consumer as to where the source of the water is actually on a little tab that's on the top of the bottle that is inserted into the top, and it's pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, Senator Maxler asked about whether we have adequate regulations. I wonder if we have a need to actually look at the size of the disclaimer or the information that's being provided to the consumer to make certain that they are aware that this is actually tap water as compared to actually coming from a spring. Because, I mean, I could see someone going in the store seeing on the label spring, Sierra Springs in a bottle and thinking they're getting spring water when in fact they're not.
Yes, Mr. Chair. About the only thing I can say on this is the requirements that we're enforcing or using in the establishments we go into are the Code of Federal Regulations. Oregon could go beyond that. We haven't chosen to. It's something we could certainly look into.
All right. It's my understanding that's on the record is that one, we can as a state have stricter regulations, greater disclosure requirements, and I understand there's states that have in fact done that.
Yes, sir, we could.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. K, thank you very much for coming this morning.
You're welcome.
And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on the issues that are before the panel now, consumer goods mislabeling issues? Mr. Wright, we're going to move forward at this point because we have a pretty tight schedule today. And if you have something else, it'd be best for you to contact us individually or through our staff in writing that we can just distribute it. Is it just a comment?
It's just a comment.
Yeah, I need you to come up just to the microphone.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Devlin had a couple questions. One of the issues on a health and safety basis that I'm looking at The foreign material that you find in a bottle, the floaties and that sort of thing, that's from a municipal tap water. Each public water supply is to give a report card. It's called a consumer confidence report for the water quality for that system. The only way that they can take that snapshot is they have an agent that goes and takes samples on that system and finds out a snapshot of the water quality on that public water supply for that day. Comes back in a week or 2 weeks, and they say, well, people on that day were drinking this quality of water. That's why I'm adamant in my belief that when you take municipal tap water and put it in a bottle, there's no guarantee of the quality of that water until people have consumed it. I have one issue when I called, my wife actually called the municipality that was selling the water to the bottlers, and she looked in their consumer confidence report, and they had a fecal, there was fecal matter in the water for up to 23 days. The bottler packaging the water. When I called the gentleman that was then system manager for the system, he denied that that happened. But because I have the ability to go through the internet, I found out that there were some inappropriate actions for the bottler, for the operators on that particular system, because there was a conflict. If they shut the system down and said, "Hey, buy bottled water or boil your water," which is the EPA remedy for an acute health violation, they would also have to do a disclaimer on that bottler: buy somebody else's bottled water or boil this bottled water. So there's a conflict when you have public water supplies selling the water to those bottlers and they don't purify it. It now becomes an extension of that public water supply, and you have to find out, it's up to the consumer to find out, well, why am I not feeling so good? So if you drank it and it had a floaty, or you drank it and it had some foreign object in there, the remedy would be purify everything and make sure you put on the bottle, this is purified, it has been treated. There was actually a case, Crystal Springs, a lady had she had consumed some water, and it had some floaties and stuff in there, and they finally, Crystal Springs, had to pay them reparations for her damages and losses. But it could be eliminated if you take a municipal tap water and just purify it so that you don't have the ability to have these floaties and these contaminations. That's what's driving the market, because of these potential contaminations within that system. So you could have just a natural spring water and a purified water, but having a purified water and a spring water and a drinking water that's just municipal tap water that's gone through some real preliminary filter, you still have the potential for getting contamination in that bottle. Another remedy, if you want to keep the drinking water, just put on the label, the system ID, and the Oregon Health Division website, where you can look at the quality that public water supply has been producing. So it's just a little more than the consumer fraud or the issue of the misrepresentation. There's actually, in my belief, there's a health aspect to this, taking municipal tap water, putting it in a bottle. Because nobody knows the quality of that the water on that given day until weeks afterward, when that once a month fingerprint or that once a month snapshot has been taken.
All right, Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to say that I do think that there are some legitimate concerns here. I just don't know how easy they are to address. One of the things in terms of municipal water, and I think we've all probably seen this if we're in a municipal water system, that they're required to give us this annual report that basically identifies all the potential contaminants. In most cases, they're relatively clean, but it's like how many days did they exceed on those test dates? And so there are certain test periods where they may have exceeded on those days. In many of our municipal water systems, you will see such things as higher elevations, not maybe higher than standards allowed, but higher elevations than are desired for lead. which is one characteristic of a municipal water system that's aging, depending upon how it was built. So I do think there's some legitimate concerns here, but if anybody looks deeply into how the FDA has chosen to label things, there is so much misleading in how the FDA has chosen to label things that we could talk for the next 5 weeks about it.
Well, thank you. Maybe one of the things we look at or consider is maybe as simple as having a requirement that it says spring water if it's spring water, purified water if it's purified, or if it's drinking water, it's drinking water. At least those three categories from what I'm hearing. So one thing, Mr. Wright and Mr. Davis, what I'd ask is that maybe you work with our staff as well as with the Department of Ag, and maybe we can come up with some solutions or some recommendations to consider in the future that could go through either the agency process or, if necessary, through the legislative process. With that, I'm going to move forward on our agenda since we're...
Senator Prozanski, there is no method for also the FDA and EPA. There's no crossover link. So this went unreported. It went reported on EPA public water supply, but completely there was no awareness. EPA needs to, or public water supplies need to call, if they're bottlers, need to call FDA, and they need to link up or share that information.
Right. Mr. Wright, I appreciate that, and that's the type of, I think, information that we need to go in greater detail, but this morning's not the time. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on the consumer goods mislabeling issues and open up on our next agenda item, which is the identity theft update. Mr. Savage?
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As you know, Oregonians have become increasingly victims of identity theft, and stories about security breaches continue to make the news. Many states have statutes that provide protections for victims and potential victims of identity theft, and there's general agreement that Oregonians need this protection as well. This committee held a hearing earlier this year to discuss the identity theft issue, and at that time, DCBS Director Corey Streisinger outlined the governor's goals for identity theft legislation. While there's general agreement that identity theft legislation is needed, there's a wide range of views as to how this should be accomplished. For this reason, Chair Prozanski, the Governor's Office, and DCBS have convened a work group to discuss the key elements for identity theft legislation. The identity theft work group had its first meeting on June 1st and has met three times. The work group meetings are open forums, and they're facilitated with the goal of getting the issues out on the table and to determine whether there's a consensus on legislation that can be introduced in the 2007 legislative session. After each meeting, draft language is prepared addressing the concepts discussed, and the draft language and meeting notes are sent out to the group for comment. After these comments are received from members of the work group, the final meetings will focus on whether a consensus can be reached on the various elements of legislation to address identity theft protection for consumers. There is agreement among members of the work group that the primary goals for identity theft legislation should be to provide a level of assurance to consumers that their personal information will be safeguarded, to decrease the incidence of identity theft in a meaningful way, to reduce damage done to victims of identity theft, to not unduly burden business and to ensure the timely flow of commerce, and to provide appropriate exceptions, and hopefully to measure outcomes if we do have legislation that we can agree upon and that gets passed in the 07 legislative session. As I said, we've had three meetings so far, and the topics have been notification to consumers when a security breach occurs, standards for safeguarding personal information, and the consumer's right to a security, or as some people refer to it, as a file freeze. The future agenda items will include the issue of protection of Social Security numbers, whether there is a way to track ID theft incidents in the state, and enforcement provisions, whether it should be a private right of action that a consumer can use, or the Department of Justice enforcement, or a combination. The future meetings will be in August and early September, the 24th of August, the 31st of August, and September 7th, and we hope to complete our work by then. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Savage? If not, thank you very much. And is there anyone else here today that wanted to give any more input? There's a very large group of people that are participating in the work group. I know a number of them are in the hearing room today, so I don't know if anyone wanted to say anything at this point or not. Give you that opportunity. If not, thank you. And we'll move on to our next topic then, which will be credit scoring initiative. Dexter Johnson, Mr. Johnson, is going to give us an overview of what the initiative is. This is one, from my understanding, that has been qualified for the ballot for November, and there was interest in at least hearing what this might do if it is passed by the voters.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council. And I have to say at the outset that ordinarily my areas of expertise are tax and public utilities, and unfortunately the people that have a lot of background in insurance have recently left Legislative Council, so I'm the last person standing here.
Drafted, I think.
The language.
So with that caveat, I'll talk a little bit about the measure, which is in concept fairly straightforward. It basically prohibits insurance companies from considering, quote, credit scores or credit worthiness in quoting or determining premium amounts. Having said that that concept is fairly straightforward, the measure has some ambiguities that in how it interacts with existing law. First of all, let me talk a little bit about existing law, which is that there is, based on Senate Bill 260 from the 2003 session, there are some rules governing the use of credit history in existing law that basically prohibit using credit history to either cancel or not refuse to renew an existing policy. But credit history may be used to in deciding whether to grant initial insurance coverage with respect to certain kinds of insurance. I don't think it is used for health or accident insurance, but other insurance, I believe it is used for that. However, it's used in a particular way. The law sets forth a requirement that insurance companies present to DCBS a insurance scoring model of which credit history is a component. And DCBS, my understanding is, must approve or works with the insurance company to approve these models. And it's through that insurance scoring process that credit history is used. Here's where we get into some of the ambiguities with this measure, because this measure doesn't talk about insurance scoring or anything like that, and instead talks about credit scores or credit worthiness. And credit worthiness is not a term that's used at all in the insurance code, is my understanding. And credit scores, I think, while there's some overlap between credit scores and insurance scores, they may not be the same thing. Credit scores are used by lenders, and insurance scoring, as approved by DCBS, is what's used by insurance companies. Not necessarily the same thing, though it is based on credit history. One of the other ambiguities with this measure is, though that's certainly something like all of these things that I'm going to talk about that can be cured by the legislature. But one of the ambiguities is that this is kind of a standalone thing. It's not actually part of the insurance code or part of added to part of ORS, which means that definitions that currently apply don't necessarily, that legally, as it's currently drafted, would not apply to this. For example, ORS currently has a definition of consumer that would make it clear that use of the word consumers, which is used in this measure, would be limited just to personal lines of insurance. But because this measure doesn't actually pick up that definition, there's some concern that, in fact, this measure would also apply to commercial lines of insurance. It is a, it's a technical issue, and I think the legislature and courts have all had experience with kind of cleanup legislation following an initiative that provides technical guidance. And this is an example of something that could be corrected quite easily.
Can I interrupt?
Yes.
Thank you. On that particular point, so this measure could, for instance, we've heard testimony in this committee of what I would consider bad builders that rip people off, maybe have tons and tons of liens or tons and tons of just a wreckage of financial ruin in their wake. And continue to build. If this measure were to be passed, a insurance company could not refuse to insure that person based on maybe that all of that bad credit or all of that bad activity in their past, because this would potentially apply to both commercial and personal insurance.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, potentially that's true. As I said, this is an ambiguity. But there is something that is a clear change, and that is that in your example, that individual would have some personal insurance. And let's say he has it right now. Let's say he doesn't have insurance right now and he wants to obtain some. Under current law, the insurance company would be allowed to consider credit history for personal or commercial insurance, and under this measure, they would not. Other ambiguities, as I mentioned, this measure talks about credit scores or credit worthiness, and neither of those insurance companies are familiar with those terms. They're not used in the code at all. Another ambiguity is about who's going to enforce this. Is it DCBS? Is it Department of Justice? The measure does not address that, or somebody else, arguably. And there's no remedy here. So if, in fact, an insurance company does consider credit factors that are disallowed by this measure, what's the remedy? The measure is unclear. As I mentioned, these are all issues that the legislature can address. There's no constitutional problem here that I'm aware of.
Any other questions from Mr. Johnson? Dexter, thank you very much. We did receive a handout from DCBS, credit scores and insurance questions and answers. I'm not sure if anyone wanted to, from the department, come forward. I don't know if it's necessary, but maybe I should ask my colleagues here if anyone had any questions based on what has been given to us. Senator Devlin?
Is there anyone here from the Insurance Commissioner's Office?
From the Insurance Commissioner's Office? Yes, there is.
The Commissioner's here herself.
The Commissioner.
Yeah.
Commissioner, as we would say.
I pulled this from their website. They didn't actually...
Oh, okay. Our staff was out surfing and found this on
yes,
the internet.
Yes, that's right.
Why
right.
Oh, you got a handout?
Well, it's probably the same thing.
The Commissioner's always ready.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Insurance Commissioner, and happy to answer any questions that you'd have, although I'm better prepared to address current law than the ambiguities of the measure.
It's actually, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, it's actually current law that I'm... I've been on the periphery of this discussion for, I don't know, a couple of sessions, because it always seems to come up. And I've seen quite a few handouts in terms of explaining it, and from different viewpoints, some people justifying it, other people saying it's not justified. I've never seen a handout anywhere that would tell me to what degree a credit score, what weight it's given in terms of how it actually impacts the cost of a policy. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. I don't know if it varies. I don't know if someone has a certain level, if their insurance goes up by 10%, 20%, 40%. I literally don't know what weight it's given, and I've never seen anything presented that tells me that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that specific question I'm not going to be able to answer because it does vary, and the specific models that insurance carriers use vary. Under current law, credit scoring cannot be used as an exclusive basis for pricing a new policy or deciding whether to issue a new policy. It can be used in conjunction with other factors, and the insurance carriers are required to submit to us actuarially valid models. That is, their pricing variations in pricing need to be justified by the correlation between the factors that they use and risk. Correlation is not the same as causation, but they do need to show correlation. The specific models under Oregon law, my understanding is, are confidential. That varies state by state, but in Oregon, my understanding is that they are confidential, although that's something that we may be looking at in more depth in response to requests that are coming to us as a result of this measure being on the ballot. So I'm not able to tell you what the actual percentage variation is that would vary by company, but it does need to be justified actuarially.
Can you give any example? There is some questions in here of when something is correlated but perhaps it's not an appropriate thing to use in terms of insurance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that can happen in one of two ways. One of them is a correlation that is valid, that is valid on the surface, but when probed, turns out to be actually not an accurate correlation. The example that we gave is a correlation between wealth and gray hair. And those two factors have some correlation potentially, but the reason that they have a correlation is that gray hair is associated with age,
Richard,
and that people who are older tend to be wealthier than people who are younger. And whether those are actually true, I don't want to weigh in on, but it's not actually gray hair, which is the factor that varies directly with wealth in that situation. It's age, and it's just that people's hair get gray when they're older. So when you look at a correlation between a factor, you want to correct for anything like that. If, for example, the way that this discussion comes up in credit scoring is people say, well, a bad credit score might correlate with some other factor, and it's really being used as a substitute for that factor, whether it's race, whether it's age, whether it's some other factor. So one question is the correlation a valid one, or is the factor that's being used actually a substitute for something else? And the reason that becomes important then is the second issue, which is there are some factors which we as a society have made a public policy judgment shouldn't be used. And those vary. There are some states, for example, that do not allow certain types of insurance to be priced differently based on sex. Other states do. Life insurance, auto insurance. Auto insurance, we in the state, you can pay a different amount for auto insurance based on having a male of a certain age in the household as opposed to a female of the same age. There are some types of pricing that we allow based on age and others that we don't. For example, in small group health insurance, we actually constrain the variation between the cheapest and the most expensive. We do allow age to be used as a factor, but not to the full extent that it would actually show up in pricing. We generally do not allow race to be used as a factor, even if it correlates. So if for example, there were statistics showing that life expectancy was different based on race, we still would not allow that to be used in pricing life insurance because we've made a policy judgment as a society that we don't allow it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
I do have one. Just maybe your observation, Mr. Eisinger, is that when I've heard about this issue from constituents in my district, which I have, as I think everybody has over time, and a few very, very active on it, one, and I know we have a lot of insurance experts sitting in the audience today, is that probably the one issue that I hear more of that really upsets is the people who have chosen not to have large credit histories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some are very well-to-do, and they just don't like having credit cards. And so they have a credit score. What they're upset about is the fact that, you know, there's not enough, you know, they get a thing back saying we can't, we're not going to deny you coverage or we're going to rate you higher because we don't have enough information from the bureaus to give you a credit score, and they buy cash. And they their business, they pay cash. They just, and those are probably a few of the higher profile complaints that I've gotten is from people that say I shouldn't, you know, because I don't have a bad credit, you know, I don't have bad credit, but I don't have a credit score. I mean, have you had, do you have any thoughts on that particular, and I don't know how large of a pool of individuals we're talking about here, but certainly they're concerned that the fact that the agencies can't, the credit reporting agencies can't figure out a credit score shouldn't penalize me when I haven't had, I don't have, quote, bad credit worthiness. Is there any way that we can tweak, you know, things to take care of that particular group or find a different way to keep them from being penalized because they make a choice not to have revolving accounts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's actually it's a very good question, one that received quite a bit of discussion and attention in the 2003 session when you passed Senate Bill 260. The issue of a neutral credit score or the absence of enough credit to give you a credit record. And the choice that the legislature made in 2003 actually was to address that head on and to say that if you don't use credit or don't have enough of a record, the insurance company has to treat you as if you have a neutral credit score. It doesn't have to treat you as if you have the gold-plated best, but it can't downgrade you from neutral based on the absence of a credit history unless the insurance company is able to present data to us showing that that actually itself, the absence of a credit history, correlates to risk. And it's my understanding, and I will double-check this if you like, that we don't have insurance companies who have chosen that route here in Oregon. So that at the moment, anyway, that should result in your being treated as neutral. And we did receive, prior to the 2003 legislation, a number of complaints and concerns about that. I don't know whether the concerns you're hearing expressed are more recent. It's not something we've been hearing a lot about recently, and so our understanding was that the 2003 legislation had made a significant difference in that regard.
Any other follow-up questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There was an interest at least at one point for maybe the opponents to the measure wanting to make some comment. I stated that we needed to at least open up the invitation to the proponents. And Mr. Sizemore was contacted. He was not able to be here. And I am going to open it up. If anyone else wants to give any comments, you're more than welcome to do so as opponents to it or as general citizens. So if there's anyone, we don't have a sign-up sheet that I've seen, but if anyone wants to make any comment at this time, please step forward. No one's up. Ms. Etherington.
Chair Prusansky and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I just want to briefly address the issue. OSPIRG believes that the use of credit scores or any form of credit history is inappropriate for insurance purposes. It's our position that the use of credit scores or other credit information should be banned as a matter of public policy when it comes to setting insurance rates and premiums. The use of credit scoring for insurance purposes is unfair to consumers. Oregonians that have been laid off or have filed medical bankruptcy, for example, two of the biggest causes for bankruptcy filings find themselves saddled with higher insurance premiums when they go to apply for new insurance here in Oregon. They have not necessarily become worse drivers or more likely to file a home insurance claim. They have merely hit hard times. And with insurance premiums tied in any way to insurance scores, unfortunately, these consumers hit even harder times. The other consideration, in addition to the to what we think is a false correlation, is the concern of inaccuracies in many credit reports and credit histories. A recent Osberg study found that one in four credit reports contained errors serious enough to result in the denial of credit. Credit reports are the foundation on which credit scores are based, and as a result of errors in credit scores, some consumers may find themselves paying higher premiums when they initially take out insurance and may not even realize it. If they do realize it, it will take quite a bit of effort on that consumer's part to rectify the situation as well. While there may be a correlation between poor credit scores and higher claims rates, we believe that that does not necessarily make it good policy. There have been studies linking all sorts of things to higher claims rates. Just a couple of sort of outlandish examples. In particular, CBSMarketWatch.com reported in 2002 on a study by the California DMV, which was interesting. It found that people with darker hair had significantly worse driving records than lighter-haired counterparts. But clearly, dyeing your hair blonde is not going to make you a better driver, necessarily. It didn't work for me, and I went back.
Any more than a person with gray hair is
exactly. Similarly. Further, the article cited an interesting Australian study that found that Geminis had the worst driving record of all the astrological signs, followed by Taurus and Pisces. So clearly, none of these characteristics have anything to do with driving, nor does a consumer's credit score. It is just as arbitrary to permit insurance premium setting on these types of characteristics as it is on credit scoring, as we believe. Really, insurance premiums should be set based on a consumer's driving history, whether they've taken a driver's ed course, how many tickets are they getting, what's actually happening with that consumer. That's what really should be determining and is most fair to determine who's a good risk, who's a bad risk, and to reward good drivers and to deter bad driving habits. We also have concerns about the potential, not only is the use of credit scoring in insurance rate setting unfair, there is the possibility that it's also discriminatory. As you've mentioned, there are people who have no credit history, minorities, seniors, low-income folks, and young people are all in groups that may have no or poor credit score. Finally, I just want to close by reiterating that Osberg's position is that the use of credit scores for insurance purposes is inherently unfair and may be discriminatory, and argue that it does no good to promote good driving or to deter bad driving, and that really should be, that is a positive use of insurance premium setting is to deter bad habits and reward good habits. The use of credit scoring fails to do that. We haven't taken a position on the measure, but this is an issue area that Osberg has been involved in for many years, and so I just want to weigh on the general policy, both on the sort of the thinking behind the 2003 law, as well as we look at this particular measure as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Etherton? Thank you very much. Again, is there anyone else that would like to come forward at this time to give any comments? I just want to make sure that you have the opportunity if you want to. Mr. Powell, we're more than willing. We've got some time on our schedule, and if you'd like to have something on the record, we're more than glad to accommodate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. One of my clients is State Farm Insurance Company. I would confine this for time to really the issues at hand as opposed to debating the entire issue, which the legislature has done, at least in my lifetime, to an exhaustive state. The legislature did handle almost every issue that's come up. My understanding is in the last year there's been 3 complaints regarding any use of credit with insurance. So we believe that the current law does deal with this issue, and fundamental to that law was the use of any kind of a credit factor can only be used on the initial underwriting insurance, cannot be used on renewal. But I do want to, in terms of getting back to the ballot measure itself, simply try to clarify a couple things. From a terminology point of view, insurance companies do not use credit scores. You, on the treadmill the other day, advertisement came out and said, if you want a free credit score, go to this website and it'll pop up. So you go, you type in your name, some other information so they make sure it's you, and a score of 600, 700, 800 to pop up. That's not what insurance companies use. Insurance companies use factors within a credit file that have shown and proven to have a correlation to future claims. And that is only one factor of many factors that are used in determining eligibility and rating in insurance, auto and homeowners insurance. So the measure that is on the ballot uses terminology that misses the mark. A court will determine whether or not those terms apply to insurance companies. We do not use credit scores. We do not use, quote, credit worthiness. We do not know what that means, and it's not defined in this measure. So clearly, it would be our plea that groups such as Osberg, if they want to address credit scoring, come to the legislature with a bill that addresses the statute, the terminologies in that statute, so that if the legislature passes that bill, everybody knows what it means. Not support a measure that is so flawed and so poorly drafted that the courts are going to struggle with many, many issues within that. The agencies involved will struggle with personnel problems because depending on the outcomes of those cases, every insurance company is going to have to refile rates and new forms based on, not forms, but rates based on some other factors. And the bottom line to consumers is that many will pay more for their insurance. And those use of those minute factors involving credit actually allow more people to be insured and start them out in the process at the fairest possible rate compared to all others being insured by that company. And to do away with it simply ignores something that is proven far beyond any way we look or the color of our hair and is used in commerce daily. So we would urge not only you but the public at large to oppose this measure for those reasons.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, in terms of not using credit scores or credit worthiness, whatever that term means, and you identified that other factors were used in evaluating credit, can you identify one or two of those?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Devlin, I do not have access to that information because it is proprietary in terms of what sub-factors within a credit report or a credit file might be used. I am aware of the methodology, however, that was used in determining those, and it is to take millions of files of of people who have history, running those files against each factor within that report to determine which ones, which of the small factors within a credit report actually do produce the correlation. But I if I wanted to get those from State Farm, I could not.
So, not to be argumentative, but if a client of State Farm's wanted to know what about their credit history was affecting their rate, could they find out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, if they are adversely affected by credit, then the general category is listed on a notification of adverse effects of the credit. In more general terms, for example, too much credit available. Somebody has 25 credit cards. Those sorts of things. Many of the things that caused problems and caused consternation amongst the real estate industry, for example, with the use of credit, is at one point shopping for a mortgage. If a person went online and had 20 hits to see what the best mortgage rate was, those attempts would be reported and used negatively. And that sort of thing's been worked out by the credit reporting agencies so that only one of those in a 30-day period would be used. So those sorts of things have been ironed out over time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Powell, thank you.
Thank you.
We're moving into our next item, which is a credit card receipts discussion. Ms. Brandis, would like to...
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. A few months ago, the committee met when there was a discussion about credit card receipts and the material that is kept by the retailer. And the question was posed, does the retailer need all the information on that credit, the credit slip that they retain? If you remember, in the 2003 session, the legislature voted for truncation of the number on the receipt that is kept by the customer. However, we argued at that time that the retailer needed more information on the receipt that the retailer kept. So I think there was a need for an updated discussion on that after the last hearing we had a few months ago. And really what it comes down to is a couple things. You probably all shop as, I was going to say, you probably all shop as much as I do, but I don't think so. I'm just going to guess. But you probably have noticed that larger retailers are moving to a system that they actually don't even keep a receipt, that they have computerized systems that track the information. They do need to keep all the information, the credit card number, the name of the client, or the customer, what was purchased, and the signature. How they keep that is more is probably different than even 3 years ago for many of them, for the large retailers. For the smaller retailers, what I found out is that they still need to keep the copy of the receipt with the full credit card number, with the signature, and the name of the customer. And the reason why is that is if there's a dispute. So stop there for a second. Go back to the large retailer. If you go to a large retailer, they don't need that information because they basically started to barcode their receipts. For example, if you try to return something at Target or if you try to return something at Nordstrom's, they just click on the barcode and you can actually get a full credit return without even showing your receipt. Very customer friendly. Smaller retailers, and I actually just walked up and down the street here in Salem talking to people the other day, they maintain those because if there is a dispute, they don't have the high-tech system. So if I purchase something from a small, maybe boutique shop, and then I get the Visa bill, and I say, oh, for heaven's sakes, I did not spend that much money at that boutique. First thing I do is I call the credit card company, and they put a hold on it. And then the retailer starts the process, and then they contact the retailer. And then the retailer starts the process of going through probably physical records of the purchases made on that date till they find the receipt for that purchase. And they have to match the credit card number, they have to match the signature, and they have to match the name. And so really it's a technology thing. I think over time you'll probably see the systems change, just as they did with the knuckle busters. As you remember, in the 2003 session, the legislature mandated that retailers get rid of the knuckle buster credit card system. That was happening anyway because the companies that own those systems generally lease them out and then upgrade them over time. And I think you'll begin to see that as systems become more sophisticated. That's going to take time because there's lease agreements associated with the credit card machines. So if you did choose to mandate a change in this, the companies you're most likely to harm are very small businesses. Less likely to harm the larger retailers. Although some of them do, as long as you're talking about the physical receipt, but they do need to maintain all that information, the name, the number, and the signature. So I hope that helps, and I can answer more questions or additional questions.
Any questions? Ms. Brandis, I do have a couple questions.
Sure.
It's really probably more my pet peeve that I'm working on this one. I go to a lot of small businesses, and depending on which one I go to, they have all of them have the electronic system, the non-knuckle buster transaction. All of those are actually, when you have the receipt printed out, it actually has an authorization code that is actually electronically being fed in and actually debits the account or actually qualifies that the money's there or it's going to be approved.
Mm-hmm.
Restaurants, which are not large retailers, actually, one of the we go to, or a number of them that we go to, but one I'm thinking right off, their receipt that they have does not have the credit card number on it. And if I'm seeing that in different retail operations, it seems to me that that day is here already because they already have to have something that's authorizing it. And it doesn't, I guess I'm having difficulty understanding why the credit card number needs to be printed on either the receipt that the merchant gets, the retailer gets, or that the consumer gets.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first, it should not be on the receipt that the consumer gets.
The consumer potentially has the last four digits.
Right, the truncation, right. the four numbers. And I did not ask that question of our retailers when I surveyed them on this the last couple of days, so I don't know.
What I'd like for you to do for me, because I am at this point looking at pushing forward legislation that would limit the number of credit card digits that are on the merchant copy, because I'm now seeing where some of them have it, and if they're all outside of the knuckle buster system, then it seems to me that if it can be done in one area, it can be done in the other. I understand there may be lease issues as to having the equipment updated and stuff like that, but we worked through that with the last legislation that we did.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, let me clarify. There are a couple things in play. The first thing is, do you need the numbers on the receipt, or does the merchant need those numbers in any way, shape, or form? And as I expressed, some of our larger retailers, not a problem. But they do need to somehow, even if it's in a coded fashion that they collect information in the more high-tech machines, they do need the number. And that's so you can easily make returns and have a customer-friendly system. I had one retailer talk a little bit about some of the other things related to... It's one thing to think about national credit cards, your Visa, your MasterCard, but you know, keep in mind also that retailers do offer their own systems of credit, and some of those retailers are actually very small. So they have to retain the copies of the receipt, including all the account information, and some of the legitimate reasons for those are the point of sales audit tapes retain the full account number so they can reconcile their records. And with the credit card issuers or the credit card associations, depending if it's a retailer-named credit card. This is required for sales and record-keeping, and especially in relation to if you want to have easy return systems. That's a choice. That's a consumer choice. Some some sophisticated as some of our systems seem, the retailer still needs a full account number in any will call situation. So if you order something from a catalog but you're picking it up at the store, catalog and internet orders are paid for prior to delivery, so the customer's card isn't present when it's made on the internet. But if they come to a will call situation, the number has to be with the retailer so that they can limit the fraud situation for the person picking it up. So then the other thing is, if you're trying to make a return or trying to check a purchase that was made, and the magnetic strip is not working, and the retailer wants to confirm that this purchase was actually made in the store, they have to be able to look at something, and that is why the retailer retains that copy. So those are some issues. Again, it's not an enormous issue with the larger retailers. Because they will have that information in some type of form, even if it isn't on a paper receipt. It will be a harder issue for the smaller retailer. And again, as you remember, the law that you all passed in 2003 did require retailers to, when they were done with that period, I think it's a year or 6 months, or I can't even remember, to shred, that they were required to dispose of that information in a proper fashion. Does that make sense? Am I clear?
It makes sense, but I'm still not convinced. Based on, if I go to a restaurant, I run a Visa card through, and both copies, the one that I signed that the store or the restaurant keeps, does not have any of my credit card numbers on it as compared to another one, something's happening that they can retract everything they need to through that process. And understand that the difference between maybe a small retailer that has their own little credit system, and maybe that's something we can build into the process. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, because we do have situations that are reported to the police where those receipts that are the merchant's copies are not being shredded if that's required by law. And maybe we need to look at sanctions to get greater compliance and enforceability, because people do dumpster dive.
Mm-hmm.
And identity theft does work through that process. That's what I'm trying to accomplish.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't think I completely understood your question the first time. So going back, a restaurant you go to, as you're describing, doesn't have the full number on the receipt that they keep.
The credit card number. They
right.
have everything else.
That just means they have a more sophisticated system. That's all. That they have. I noticed today when I was getting gas, same type of thing. They don't keep a copy of my number or anything. It's just a more sophisticated system. That's what you would be mandating upon smaller retailers. And that's your choice as a legislator. And my point was that type of mandate will have broader implications on a smaller retailer, not all of them, but on some of them, and less implication on a larger retailer. Because even if you don't see that information on the receipt, we're retaining it through a computer system.
Right, where it's more secure and it's not going into
sure.
the dumpster.
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And I believe Laura Etherson wanted to make comment on this.
Hi, Chairperson and members of the committee. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here today to testify on another topic. Again, I'm Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with OSPIRG. And I appreciate the chance to talk to you about ways that protect consumers from identity theft, including limiting the amount of credit card information listed on receipts. Identity theft is currently the most significant example of what happens when a consumer's personal information ends up in the wrong hands. Almost everyone has a story about themselves or someone they know whose identity was stolen, and how many weeks or months or even years it took to rebuild their finances, rebuild their good name and their good credit history. Currently, gaps in the system are making it both too easy for identity thieves to get their hands on personal information, and it's too easy for identity thieves to then get credit issued to them in their victim's name. These gaps are fairly huge, and particularly acute here in Oregon. The Federal Trade Commission ranks Oregon as the 13th state in the nation for identity theft. Osberg's an active participant in the ID theft work group facilitated by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we really look forward to working together with all the parties to continue on the mutual goal of stopping identity theft and the damage that it causes both to businesses and to consumers. Overall, to protect consumers, it will take a broad, comprehensive strategy with a lot of different parts, stopping the flow of information to identity thieves and making it much harder for them to get credit issued to them. More and more states are enacting laws that put really powerful tools into place. The work group is discussing a number of those, such as security breach notification and giving consumers the right to a security freeze that's easy and effective. In addition to those pieces, it is, we think, a good idea, certainly for the merchant copy of a credit card receipt to be truncated and to not list the full consumer's credit card number, expiration date, have that signature right there. As you can imagine, if a thief gets a hold of those receipts, it is just an absurdly easy way for them to steal people's identities. It's a little gold mine right there. You've got the full credit card number, the expiration date, the person's name, their signature right there. It's just too darn easy. We applauded when, in 2003, the legislature passed the bill to eliminate all but the last four digits of a customer's credit or debit card receipt. Of course, that only applied to the customer's copy of the receipt. And later that year, Congress passed the Fair and Accurate Credit Transaction Act of 2003, or FACTA, which added new sections to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And that act says that the credit and debit numbers may not include more than the last five digits and cannot include the card's expiration date, which is another important piece. It does not apply to manual collection of credit card numbers, and that is going into effect now as well. Again, this only applies to the cardholder's copy, so we're still left with the merchant's copy having the receipt number on it. As you mentioned, for example, at restaurants, it's fairly common for the consumer to sign their name on the receipt and then to walk away, leaving that receipt on the table that includes all that information, and that certainly puts people at risk. Additionally, a retailer, a merchant who has stacks of consumers' receipts that have all that important information, it's an enticing target for an identity thief, and we think it would be wise to remove that target altogether and just remove those paper stacks of personal information altogether by truncating the number. Many retailers, as has been mentioned, have already taken this important step on their own and upgraded their technology. And I think those retailers really need to be applauded for taking that step and for removing the information from both the merchant copy and the customer copy. More and more, I think it's the exception when you notice that the merchant copy is going to have that full receipt. It really is the exception to the rule more and more these days. We certainly think it's a smart idea to make sure that no matter where a consumer shops, that they can be sure that their credit card or all that credit card information is not going to be kept in a paper format from then on. And I think that's an important issue to explore in the next legislative session, and we're interested in being part of that dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give comment on the credit card receipts? Moves us into the governor's alternative to payday loans. Ms. Dreisinger and Ms. Leavitt, you're also on here. Did you want to go separate or come up together? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and your committee administrator asked me to be here today to briefly describe the program which we announced last week involving credit unions and handing out some information about that. Just briefly, as you know, and as we've discussed in a number of hearings concerning short-term lending, we are certainly of the view that there is a need in Oregon for short-term small loans, and we're interested in ensuring that Oregonians have access to credit on a short-term basis. And for the past couple of years, we've been working with Oregon's credit unions to offer such, to encourage them to offer such short-term loans. And a number of them, in fact, now do so. You can see the list in front of you. What we announced last week was the kickoff of an outreach program to help Oregon consumers who have a need for low-cost loans become aware of these alternatives and assist them in finding a credit union, if they so choose, that can offer them a payday-type alternative at a lower rate. And we have this information, as we announced last week, is now available on a website and through an 800 number that will essentially assist consumers interested in this program in locating a credit union in their community that they are eligible to join that can offer this type of loan. So that's the information that that we have in front of you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Streisinger, for being here. I just have a question. The 800 number and the website, who's paying for that?
It is, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr provided at no cost to us. The nonprofit organization that operates this, it is a nonprofit organization that's in the business of providing referrals for a wide variety of health and human services, health and human services, and it does have contracts with a number of governmental entities to provide that information, but because this is a single, easily managed, small source, we do have an agreement with this entity that does not involve any cost.
Answer the question, who's paying for this?
Chair Senator Starr, I guess I would have to say SafeNet is paying for it. They are not charging us for it.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Who's responsible for the content on the website?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we have provided that to them. And I will say we are paying for the outreach. Our department is paying for the brochures, and we are co-sponsoring with the Credit Union Association a public service announcement.
And how much is that?
The total cost of the outreach is, I believe, roughly $15,000. We are paying for that out of a consumer education fund that is the result of, from time to time, we are participants in lawsuits that result in the defendants in those lawsuits being required to pay the state money to be used for consumer financial education purposes. And that is the fund that we're using to pay for this.
Follow-up. Your expenditure of the $15,000 didn't require any legislative authority at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that's correct. It is within our legislatively approved expenditure limitation.
And follow-up. It seems to me that the state is spending state dollars to promote a private entity, private businesses. You're encouraging Oregonians to frequent, at least it's a long list, but it's a good list of Oregon credit unions. You see any conflict of using public dollars to basically encourage Oregonians to take part in supporting a particular list of Oregon businesses?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we do consumer outreach all the time, and we do, for example, encourage people to purchase insurance to protect themselves. We educate people about the value of various types of financial services that we regulate. So I don't view this as different in kind from the types of activities that we do engage in on a regular basis. What we are doing is, we hope, informing consumers about the choices that are available to them.
And last question. You know, you've got these two one-page documents here. How are you, what, the $15,000, is it just on printing? How are you distributing these? Are you doing radio or television ads, billboards, or what's, how's the $15,000 going to be spent? And how, you target, and how are you targeting your audience? What, talk to me a little bit about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the bulk of it is we are going to be doing a public service spot that will run on radio and TV, and so we do put some money into the airtime for that, and then the printing costs for the brochures. It's a fairly modest campaign, but that's what the bulk of the time, of the dollars are for. There was also some cost involved in producing the spot.
Which brought up another question, Mr. Chair. $15,000 for radio and television ads and printing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, this is a program that the broadcast associations run, which is public service oriented, so it is not. We do not pay for commercial rates of time.
Oh, so you're basically getting free airtime on television or radio, free spots?
PSAs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, in part, yes.
Well, that's good for the credit unions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we think it's good for the credit unions. We hope it's good for Oregonians, too.
One question, if I could follow up, and that's the distribution of the two documents. How is that being done? What type of locations are they being made available? I assume the payday loan companies are not putting these out for people to gather.
Mr. Chair, I assume that's correct. We are distributing them to social service organizations who tend to work with the populations that are most vulnerable.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I think I'll start by letting Senator Starr know, since I just signed the bill, that we did pay Credit Unions in Oregon $10,000 for the public service announcement. I'm not aware of the total budget dollars, but our portion that Oregon Credit Unions pitched in was $10,000. And I bought a copy that you can watch of the public service announcement if you're interested in seeing that.
Okay. Is that?
I don't know how you do it on here, but...
Yeah, we should be able to capture that.
Okay, here, I'll just give you the CD.
The cameras, if she points it this way, it should pick up at this camera here. Oh, I see. Okay, we can...
She has a CD.
Oh, okay, she has a CD. Oh, I see.
Excuse me.
Can you help her?
This is handy for camping trips, car trips. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I did testify before you on our short-term loan products. The state did encourage many of our credit unions to offer these products a couple years ago. Many of our credit unions have always offered a short-term loan product to their members to get them by. We don't see these as a payday loan. Industry pressure, I think we've been calling them, but they're really short-term loans to get our members through a difficult time. Credit unions see their mission as not-for-profit financial cooperatives to not just get the payday loan to the member and send them on their way, but to provide them with counseling and seminars and other products that might help them during a difficult time. Every single one of my CEOs who've talked to me about their products have said that our goal is to have our members not use these products. And so that's how we see ourselves as being a little bit different. I did provide you with testimony on some of the variety of short-term products that our members offer. And the new news, as the department has testified, is that we are partnering to do these public service announcements. One of the criticisms I've had testifying before committees has been, great, Pam, you have these programs, but nobody knows about them. And so I have asked our members to put up some money to help with these public service announcements. And we are benefiting from greatly reduced rates to do this. So we appreciate being able to get this out to the consumers, and hopefully they'll look to credit unions as an alternative. So if you want to look at them, you can use it.
Hi, I'm
Yeah. I guess I can add our focus and our legislative agenda will continue to promote financial education starting at the student level. We continue to see problems in Oregon and certainly around the nation with consumers really understanding the difficulties in managing their credit, mortgages, all of those very technical, difficult financial issues. And without personal finance in the Oregon curriculum anymore, it's up to outside groups like our organization and many other associations in Oregon who get into the schools, get in with senior groups, and really teach basics. So I encourage the legislature to continue to think about financial education as an area that we need to focus on. Senator Metzger has certainly helped me in that area and led the way in looking at possible legislation, and we're going to do that again for next session.
Some more waiting questions from Ms. Leavitt? Yeah.
I don't know. I played it on my computer.
No, this is a video. It should be DVD.
Reading. Maybe it was just. Okay. Maybe it was just inserted before the machine was ready to do its thing.
Everyone having a great summer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin next to me here just told me he's making some notes that it's only 22 weeks from Monday, 22 weeks to the session starts. So just
he would be the one that would.
Of course, I didn't want to know that.
22 weeks. Well, considering what in the second month of our summer in the Northwest.
Yeah, right.
It's too soon.
Here comes the expert.
Tell us what we already know.
Well, it looks like we'll be moving right along.
Yeah.
Here. No.
Well, maybe after the meeting, the watch time here.
That's fine. We'll go ahead and move forward. So I'll open up the, dais for anyone who might want to come forward to give any comments regarding the alternative to payday loans that we've received, since we do have some time here. Not seeing anyone running and jumping up. We'll go into our last topic that we have scheduled for today, which is the Construction Contractors Board update. And Mr. Smith and Mr. Long are here. If y'all would like to come up together, that'd be great.
Senator Pruzanski, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. For the record, I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and it's a pleasure to be here today to talk to you a little bit about the Task Force on Construction Claims. I'm joined by Mark Long of the Building Codes Division, and Mark has been the key person who has staffed this task force, and he's prepared to provide you a report. I'll limit my conversation to answering your questions as time permits.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long. I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Building Codes Division. We are passing out a couple pieces of information to update you on the task force, just general information. We continue to update our website. We have over 300 submissions to our website, 330 individuals signed up. I believe we've had 9 meetings of the task force, if my memory serves me correct. We are in what we call the second phase of the task force, where we're studying the insurance issues. We've had 2 meetings on the insurance side of the equation, with a third scheduled in August and wrap up in September. During the insurance phase, and I'll wrap back to the construction defect phase, the first phase, we've had a presentation from a consultant that we hired at the department to study some of the insurance issues, and I've got some excerpts from his or their overview. We've heard from the agents, we've heard from a company, and we've heard from individuals specializing in residential warranties and other national perspectives. Just to give you a sense, we anticipate begin drafting our report to you, if you will, the legislature as a whole, in September, and then honing up that report through October, November, December, obtaining public comment through those months, and then turning it in by the January due date. If you look at the first document that I have, these are the recommendations that have come out of phase one, and staff is currently drafting concepts related to these particular issues. We have broken them down under the various areas that the task force has looked at, under consumer information, building code standards, design requirements, workforce standards, things that impact construction generally speaking, additional enforcement tools, and then ongoing maintenance. Of particular note, the task force has been interested in the recovery fund concept under the enforcement piece, some of the emergency suspension enforcement tools, training and education for contractors that work on building envelope under the workforce category, certifying those individuals. There's a range of building code standards to try to tighten up the regulations to prevent moisture from getting in. And then upfront information to the consumers under the consumer information category to make sure that consumers have adequate information at the time of a bid. That's phase one. I've also provided these are very brief excerpts, that I thought would be interesting.
Mr. Long?
Yeah.
Before we go to that one, a couple of questions on the concepts. I noticed that like concept two is listed in 2 or 3 different categories. I'm assuming that concept is going to just have interface within those different categories.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We broke it down so that you could see the themes, and then these concepts affect multiple areas. So concept two, training, community education, obviously can impact the design depending on how that's done, the workforce, and then on the job, frankly.
Right. Then the other thing I noticed is that you have like concept 1, 2, 3, then it looks like it jumps to 5, 8, and 9.
Yes.
Those are the ones that we're working on, or are there other concepts that represent 4, 7, and whatever else are going to be somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I should have provided some context. When the committee began receiving the recommendations, I think we received 65 or 70 total from a variety of sources. Those continued to get windowed down to where I think we were operating with 10 or 15. Back in May, there were specific motions to draft particular ones, and those are represented here.
Okay.
There are other ones that are still under discussion, but we're not in the drafting and detail stage, if you will.
Thanks for the clarification.
Sorry about that. Regarding the insurance side, I just wanted to we're early into it. The way we're laying out the task force is we kind of go through an overview, what are some of the perspectives. Then we ask folks to come in to give us recommendations. We take those list of recommendations. We hone them down. We ask for the public to come in and comment, and then that leads into drafting of concepts. We're going to go through that same process with insurance. But I thought you might be interested in just some of the initial information. This came from, again, a consultant that the department procured to look at the range of insurance solutions, and this is out of a 30-page presentation that was made last week, I think, or the week before. And I thought you'd be interested to know if you just look at it from a pie chart. And again, this is limited based on a data call that the consultant went out to the various insurance agents or companies and gathered information. But if you look at the issues of defects, cause of losses, you can see that a great majority of it is dealing with water intrusion, so we want to make sure that on the construction site that we're addressing that. If you look at the location of the defect, a lot of it is in the envelope. So, again, you see kind of a pattern here of making sure that we're focusing any of the remedies in the areas that folks are having difficulty. If you look at the type of residence that primarily in the residential market, when you're looking at it from a consumer's perspective, you can see how it's broke down in the pie chart between custom homes, multifamily, condo, and tract. I won't go into detail. It's fairly self-explanatory. And then there are a range of issues that the consultant is looking at to provide recommendations to the task force around warranty, wrap policies, loss control discounts, experience rating, et cetera. So we're in the middle of that. I'll know more later on this fall where we're at with insurance and with the defects when we begin drafting in September. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Questions? Don't look like we have any. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
We can't let you off that easy.
I had some questions about a different thing I realized I don't want to believe. So if I could, please, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, maybe in, as a new member of the committee, you may have covered something earlier in the interim. But I just wanted to take the opportunity, since you guys were here, to go back to some of the issues that Senator Starr and I dealt with in the business committee, and we'd be curious for an update. Two unrelated ones, but if you could just briefly tell me where we are. Number one was we had extensive hearings about the concern about the cost of insurance, the availability of insurance for contractors. So any comments on what the feedback you've been getting in terms of where we are in terms of that concern? Has that been mitigated? Do we still have a serious problem with cost and availability from what you're hearing? That would be the I think the first one that I'd like to ask. And then the second one would be any progress or comments you might make on an issue that we had for the consumer with the Construction Contractors Board, where we would hear from folks who weren't paying claims, who had a lot of complaints, and then they would just start another company with the same principles, and they would be checked out, and it looks like, you know, they have no complaints against them, but they're basically the same guys, and we weren't doing anything about keeping them from starting new DBAs and stuff. So comments on those two issues, I would just be curious about.
Senator Prusansky, Senator Metzger, the issue about insurance, of course, that's one of the main reasons, I think, for the Task Force on Construction Claims to analyze both the degree of problems that contractors are having getting insurance and what the possible alternatives might be, and to provide you with that feedback and perhaps legislation. I can tell you that from my perspective, the phone continues to ring, and we continue to receive some surveys from licensees indicating that they're having problems getting liability insurance. With that said, I think it's also fair to say that the phones have rung a little less often, and I think there has been some progress made. I think that more contractors are getting insurance, or they're just getting used to paying the additional amount of insurance that's now required. But to say that it's completely resolved, I think, would not be accurate. On the second issue having to do with the change of business entities, although there is discussion from some consumers about this issue, we currently have legislation, or we currently have statutory authority to keep owners and operators of a construction corporation. If they run up construction debt today, in other words, either lose in court or lose at the CCB, and then don't pay that debt, we can keep those owners and officers from starting new construction businesses. We've instituted additional procedures to see to it that that doesn't happen, and in the event that it does happen, if one gets through and we find out about it, we immediately suspend the license. The big problem here is bankruptcy, because if that contractor successfully discharges that debt in bankruptcy, we are not able to keep that contractor from acquiring a new business entity, whether it's an LLC or a corporation or even starting off on their own. So that remains a concern.
Would that, Mr. Chair, would that require legislation? You say it's a concern. Is that because you can't, through your rules, handle that situation, and we would need to work with you legislatively, or...
Senator Prusansky and Senator Metzger, it may be a constitutional issue because of the bankruptcy law, of course, is in the Constitution, and we may not have a remedy to this. We're working with our agency counsel. One of the legislative proposals that we're going to bring before you is a requirement of contractors to notify the Construction Contractors Board in the event that they do file bankruptcy. And if you determine that this is a good idea, we'll record that, and we will display that to the public so that the public at least knows if a contractor has filed a recent bankruptcy and has discharged debt. Currently on our website, when we do find out about discharged debt, we display that on the contractor's license so that the public understands that this contractor has availed themselves of the services of bankruptcy and some debt has been discharged.
Right. Mr. Smith, you did send me an email regarding the need to maybe have access to police records and stuff like that. Do you want to, I don't know if you'd like to bring that up now to discuss for the committee, just to get an understanding, and I apologize, I have not gotten back to yours. I actually was out of state part of last week.
Thank you, Senator Prostansky. And for the committee, this is a legislative concept that we have had on the table before, and we would really like some support on because we feel it's integral to our ability to stop construction fraud. From time to time, the worst offenders are not licensed contractors. People that masquerade in contractor clothing go from door to door, suggest that that a consumer has a problem with their roof or their chimney, take substantial amounts of down payment. Sometimes they prey upon the elderly, and it's all kind of underground. We can't see it. When we find out about that sort of thing, we use our special investigations unit and local law enforcement to try to address that as simple theft. But the first course of action is to identify the offender. And we may have a name of John Smith or Bill Kowalski, but to identify which person we're talking about, it's helpful if we have a photograph. Sometimes we get those photographs from a variety of sources, but oftentimes these individuals have Oregon driver's licenses. And the ability to, from time to time, on a very limited basis, the ability to get those photographs and show them to our victims to say, is this the individual that took your money, would be very helpful to us. And it would require a statutory change. It may be worth doing. In your mind, I would hope that you would allow us to do so.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, and we'll talk more on that.
Thank you.
And is there anyone else who wanted to give comment today regarding the topic of Construction Contractors Board update? If not, I think we've completed our work.
Efficient, Mr. Chair.
I want to thank Senator Mex for being willing to step in at this time in the interim to work with us on the committee. We have one other meeting currently scheduled in October. There's a possibility, if necessary, we could maybe have a subsequent meeting to that. But Rick, thank you very much. And with Senator Ringo stepping out, it's great to have a full committee, and thank you for being here today. And thank you all for being here, committee members. With that, we're going to adjourn, and thank everyone for participating today.